an unimaginable tragedy.
When we stepped outside of the apartment, I looked to the left and the roof was completely caved in on the apartment to our left. Looked forward, which is where the elevators are, and it was just a shaft and a hole.
Part of a beachside condominium building just collapsed in the middle of the night. Dozens of people were rescued. Dozens more remain missing. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. What's the latest on the search and rescue efforts in Surfside? And how much is the community helping in these early days after such horrific physical and emotional trauma, with lives shattered, homes destroyed, and the sense of security gone? In these early hours of searching for a cause, what questions will investigators be asking to find out what happened? It's all ahead on our program, made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Thanks for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson. Albert Aguado came to South Florida from New Jersey with his wife and two kids for a vacation. They were asleep in the Champlain Tower South building early Thursday morning when part of it collapsed.
It woke me up. I felt the entire room shake. She jumped out of bed to check on the kids. They were okay. We looked out the balcony. It was all a cloud of smoke. We went out to the balcony. The fire department was getting there. We yelled down, "Should we get out?" And they said yes. So at that point, grab your stuff, go. We still didn't know how urgent it was.
It was urgent. Dozens of condominiums were gone, vanished, and an unknown number of people who may have been inside those homes.
When we stepped outside of the apartment, I looked to the left, and the roof was completely caved in on the apartment to our left. Looked forward, which is where the elevators are, and it was just a shaft and a hole. And then luckily the exit sign, because we lost power, luckily the exit sign for the stairwell was working. We got into the stairwell, like half the wall was missing there. Now it's just race downstairs because we don't know if the rest of the building is going to collapse.
It all happened in seconds. Video shows it starting in one tier of the 12-story beachside building. A second tier fell, both in 10 seconds.
Start racing down in the dark and just calling to each other, "You still there? You still there?" Because it's a race against time. When we got to about the third floor, there was a young girl with a elderly woman. She was like 88, 90. And she was like, no, you guys got to slow down because you're going to trample her. So then we tried to work, make sure we got her out.
55 condominiums where people had been living, visiting, working, sleeping, were gone.
When we got down to the bottom floor, there was flooding beginning. Then we had to crawl up some rubble to get back up to the poolside floor. With the elderly lady, we were able to push her up over there, and then once we got to the pool area, just run to the beach just to get away, because again, you didn't know if the rest of it was going to come down.
A day and a half after this catastrophic collapse, 159 people are unaccounted for. Four people are confirmed dead. We're going to spend this hour here on the South Florida Roundup talking about the latest efforts to find survivors, community donations and help for those dealing with this tragedy, and the early but important question, why did this happen? 800-743-9576 is our phone number to join our conversation here live on this Friday in South Florida. 800-743-9576 to share your questions, your concerns, your experiences, 800-743-WLRN or at WLRN on Twitter. WLRN reporter Katie Switalski-Munoz spoke with Miami-Dade County Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava just after 12 p.m. today on this Friday to hear the latest from the scene on the county's role.
Thanks for joining the South Florida Roundup, Mayor.
I'm delighted to be with you. Thank you.
This morning, you announced that the number of people identified as missing has increased up to 159. And we now know that four people have died, but 120 people have also been accounted for and marked safe. So I'm just wondering, you know, what else have you learned after first responders spent all of last night in search and rescue mode?
Yeah, thank you. Actually, we're up to 127 people that have been located, which is great news. The 159 you say are missing, we for sure do not know that they are actually missing. So these are people that may or may not have been in the building. So we just want to be very clear about that. And we're hopeful that many of them were someplace else having a safe time. But our rescue team has been working feverishly all through the night, all through the day. They do not stop. And in fact, we've just been joined by the City of Miami expert team. Ours is Task Force One, theirs is Task Force Two. I've learned that this is a special designation from FEMA because of the expertise of the team. And we're so fortunate to have two teams right here in Miami-Dade County. And, you know, only so many can work at a time. So they are working in shifts, 12-hour shifts, and they're continuing search and recovery because they are very optimistic. They continue optimistic. They're looking for fissures, holes that they could get through. They're listening for sounds. They are with dogs, with equipment. We now have cranes and on the top, some heavy equipment, some light equipment below, clearing pathways so that we can continue to seek people in the rubble.
And you had mentioned to MSNBC this morning that the last time someone was found alive was yesterday morning, but it sounds like first responders are still hopeful at this point while they continue.
Let me say they're not only hopeful, they're extremely motivated. In the Haiti earthquake, they found people alive 7 days later. You know, we hear these stories everywhere, and you know what? These people were on the scene. They were part of those rescue efforts. This is the best team in the nation. They are going in to save lives.
Well, and what are you focused on today as county mayor?
I have spent time with the family members who are waiting anxiously for news of their loved ones. We're making sure that they have everything they need for their immediate comfort, their food, their shelter, assistance with their basic needs. I was in touch with the president yesterday. We got the emergency order through. Now FEMA is on site. So we're making sure that the FEMA application process is moving forward. We've got donations flowing. Cash donations is what we want at this time, not goods. So the supportsurfside.org has already raised $100,000. That's wonderful news. And we're here making sure that the public knows the latest. We're talking to the media.
Well, and you did mention President Joe Biden did approve the emergency declaration for Florida today. How does that declaration help recovery efforts?
Yeah, it's huge. It's actually unprecedented. So we're going to be able to use those dollars to help us with the search and rescue operation. It will allow us to get federal support for those efforts, which, of course, are extraordinary, but we are taking every measure regardless of cost. And then there's the debris removal. That will be extremely expensive, and having FEMA support will be critical. And then there's the individual assistance to the families, and that will be very, very important.
And what support has the state provided so far, and what more is expected to come from both the state and the federal government?
Federal and state are working together on the FEMA relief. We have a state coordinator for FEMA, and our director of emergency management for the state is on site as well. We have a number of personnel coming in additionally from the state emergency management. So they help with the coordination of the resources. And there are some applications that people can make for assistance from the state as well. And we'll be getting all that information and putting those systems in place.
And you mentioned that the City of Miami is sending a team to help as well today. What are the agencies on site? Who is leading charge while this continues?
Our Department of Fire and Rescue for the county is responsible for the search and rescue operation at the site and the safety and security at the site. Our Miami-Dade County Police Department is working with the police in Surfside to secure the area. And assist with traffic flow. We have, obviously, as was mentioned, FEMA and the state emergency management working on assistance to the individuals. And then we have the City of Surfside that is responsible for the building issues, the overall safety of their residents. And on top of that, we've got the state attorney and victim advocates here. We have our County Department of Social Services. We have volunteers from other fire departments all across the county, and even fire rescue from Broward County. it's an extraordinary effort of so many people coming together. And honestly, to come and look at it, you would feel that it was a well-greased machine. Everybody is working together seamlessly, and there are no gaps, and the communication is stellar.
Is there anything else, Mayor, any other information you feel it's important to share at this time?
The most important thing is for the families who are waiting, and we want them to know that we are working around the clock. These are our families. We're here for them. We will spare no effort, no cost in securing the safe rescue of their family members. And we have the best team to do it. So have hope. We have hope. Our fire rescue team has hope, and we're here for you.
Thank you very much, Mayor.
Thank you.
Miami-Dade County Mayor Daniela Levine Cava speaking with WLRN's Katie Swatowski-Munoz about an hour ago here for the South Florida Roundup. Tina Paul joins us now, the vice mayor of the town of Surfside. Vice Mayor Paul, thanks for your time today.
Thank you. And thank you for all the support and concern for our town.
Well, it's an incredibly trying time for the town of Surfside and for the entire area with this inexplicable tragedy. What can you share with us in terms of the assistance that the town of Surfside, a small village, right, beachside, that it is receiving? What's necessary here today as we're 36 hours after this unimaginable tragedy?
Well, we're a small town, beach town, exactly, and we primarily we're being inundated with graciousness from our neighbors and just people who want to help, which is a good thing. We're getting like lots of things delivered here: food, clothing, cell phone chargers. So I'm not sure how much in need we are. Because so many companies and individuals and businesses have reached out to us to help. So we feel that in the coming days we will continue to need things. So at some point it's like an abundance of things right away, and mm-hmm. It gets a little overwhelming. So we're trying to manage all that because it's a little bit much for the town. You know, we have nowhere to put these things in our space.
And
we want to make sure it gets to the right people.
Yeah, there's a practical issue about dealing with the items that have been donated. But I think when you talk about feeling overwhelmed with the support, I think overwhelmed is perhaps a great word that a lot of people here are feeling, and certainly those who are directly impacted by it, those residents of the Champlain Tower South, the family members, the friends who are still waiting for word about those folks who are unaccounted for. What can you share with us about those efforts to find the people who are still listed as missing?
Well, the efforts are definitely ongoing. I was at yesterday. I spent the day between the site and the community center where the residents and family members are waiting. And today, I've mostly been at the community center and at our town hall. I plan to go by the site later today. We have so many different organizations from Miami-Dade County and neighboring municipalities helping in the rescue, and our own public works is working with them, and our police force and other police forces from different jurisdictions. So they pretty much have that under control in terms of doing what they do best. This is what they know how to do. And
what kind of expectations can you share with those folks that are waiting for word, waiting for any kind of word, and holding on to hope that those who are missing will be found and found alive?
Well, I believe in never giving up hope. So I continue to have hope for them, that there's people that I know that are there, and I'm hopeful that they'll be found. There's two elderly couples I know of that are unaccounted for, and One couple we believe is there, and the other one we don't know if they were there or if they were away. So that's an issue too. Some of the missing people might not have been there at the time. But definitely we know that there are ones that are there and are missing. And it's critical to find them, you know, in either way, in either form.
Yeah.
And we'll do everything we can. We, you know, it's a delicate situation because, you know, we don't want the rescuers to get hurt either. And it's, you know, because we don't know the condition of the structure that's still standing there. And right. When you move things, it shifts. So, you know, the rescue workers know what they're doing, and we just really have to be patient. And I know that's not what people want to hear, but it's the reality. We're not stopping. It's just a slow process.
Vice Mayor, stick with us. Tina Paul, Vice Mayor of the Town of Surfside. WLRN's healthcare reporter, Veronica Zaragovia, was at the scene for a good part of yesterday. She's with us today from Surfside. Veronica, thanks for sharing your reporting. What can you add to the mayor, the vice mayor's comments, and just share with us what you're experiencing today as the search and rescue efforts are continuing?
Well, I stopped by town hall to see if they had any information on what people should donate, because I think there's some confusion on whether any items are still necessary and kind of where to take them. And while I was there, I saw a bunch of people, including from the Red Cross, that were delivering water. I walked over to the community center a few blocks away on Collins and 93rd. And it seemed like there were maybe fewer people outside. I don't know if now people are just kind of being taken to temporary housing in greater amounts, so that there's not as many people at the center. We're not allowed inside, so I can only just kind of take a look. And that part is still a little bit difficult to gauge who's organizing which efforts and how people can still help.
Yeah. Vice Mayor Paul, how about that in terms of kind of the controlling, or if there is a singular kind of point of contact for that? Coming up, we're going to talk more about some of the donations and charitable giving here, but for those who are in need, what is that sense of leadership, I suppose?
Right. Well, we're working on organizing all the resources that have been offered to us. I mean, prior to joining you, I had received a call from our FPL representative who basically offered anything we need. And at this point, you have to ask what it is, because, you know, when you have people offering you things, you need to think of what do you need, what you might need down the road, and what you have enough of at the time. So, you know, we're working on, you know, our staff is working on compiling a whole list of, you know, who's offering what, and that way we can, you know, allocate it to the people who need it. We have three different camps of people right now. We had, you know, I was there at the community center, you know, about an hour after this had happened, and there were residents from, we had two camps of people. There were residents from the collapsed Champlain Towers, and there were visitors who were displaced from the hotel across the street, because it was, you know, we wanted to be sure they were safe and the building had collapsed right next to them. So all those people have been relocated to hotels. And now what we have at the community center are the family members that are looking for, you know, they're waiting to find out of their where their family is. And so it's shifted. And what I was suggesting earlier to our staff was finding a way to get some of these donated items to the people that are in the hotels, because even though we place them in hotels, they really have the clothes off their backs. They didn't get to take anything with them. And it's very frustrating for them. I've spoken with a woman who's caring for this man. I helped her find him that night because she said he wouldn't know to go to the community center and he's just walking around. So I said, well, I'll go with you. Let's walk. And we found him, and she's been taking care of him since. And we got him into a hotel, and now I saw her again at the community center, and she said she's taking in the clothes shop. And I said, well, things are donated here. Let's see what you can get here that you know, people, because that's the purpose. They're giving it for a purpose. Right. You want it to go to that purpose.
Sure. Yeah. Let me remind folks, we're talking, of course, about this catastrophe in Surfside, the Champlain Towers South partial condominium collapse, and some of the latest information here today on the South Florida Roundup on this Friday afternoon. 800-743-9576. Your questions about giving, your questions about next steps, your questions about search and rescue, 800-743-WLRN. The vice mayor of the town of Surfside, Tina Paul, is with us, as well as WLRN's Veronica Zaragovia. Vice Mayor, before we lose you, I want to ask you a question in terms of the real focus now on looking for those 159 people who remain unaccounted for. Are there intact property records of who was in the building, residents or owners or visitors?
That's a little bit complicated because the town wouldn't have that. That would be, the building would have that. The building management would have that. The building security would know that. And
do you know if it exists? We've done,
it should exist. I live in a condo and it exists in my condo, but I can also tell you the difficulties in keeping track of that is that you have unit owners that aren't there, or they have a relative staying in their unit, or they've rented it out. So it can get a little sketchy. And what we've also had since the COVID is that a lot of people have relocated here and moved here, and then people have moved away. So you have a lot of turnover on these apartments, whether it's ownership or rental, and the building would keep track of that. They have to, because they're they manage the building. What we've done in the town is that at the community center we have a list of, they have a computer and there's a officer there, and you give him the names of the people you're looking for, and he compiled the whole list. So that's how we know who is missing, you know, who is unaccounted for. And you know, I suppose the list had increased since, you know, this has progressed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. We learned early this morning, on this Friday morning, that the list of the unaccounted for names, in fact, did increase overnight as more people reported missing loved ones and friends and associates. Tina Paul, the vice mayor of the town of Surfside, with us. Veronica Zaragovia, you were there yesterday. You're there today. Just give us a sense. Describe today's scene and what's happening at the site of this catastrophe today.
Yeah, well, today when I got to this, as close as I, well, there, you know, now there, it's kind of like different parts where you can try to get a view of what's going on. And from about Harding Avenue, you could smell the smoke very strongly. It's been raining quite a bit throughout the day, so that's kind of difficult for those who are involved in the rescue efforts. But we know that for now, the rescue efforts will continue for some time before it has to be turned into a recovery, and at which point it might be that the Miami-Dade Homicide Unit would get involved. Mm-hmm. And but it's and the Governor Ron DeSantis is scheduled to be at the Shula Bell Harbor at about 2:00, so that's coming up. And it's just a little less, you know, yesterday all day I heard helicopters overhead, and I'm not hearing them today. So it's in a way a little less busy in terms of the ambulances and the police and those kind of sounds, but certainly everybody's still just very, very concerned, and I'm seeing a lot of activity from the, you know, the donations and all.
Yeah. In fact, we're going to talk more about the community support, the charitable giving, and the kind of assistance that the residents, the family, the friends, the neighbors, colleagues of folks directly affected by this catastrophe will need now and are going to need in the future. Veronica Zaragovia, healthcare reporter here at WLRN. Stick with us. Vice Mayor Tina Paul of the town of Surfside. Vice Mayor, thanks for sharing your time with us here today on WLRN.
Thank you. And thank you for continuing to keep our community in your thoughts and prayers.
Absolutely. SupportSurfside.org is the website that's been set up by three foundations, three charitable foundations, have partnered together for supportsurfside.org. And right at the top of our homepage online at WLRN.org, you can find ways to help those survivors of the Champlain Towers South building collapse. WLRN.org. More to come here on the South Florida Roundup, including that charitable giving, what's necessary now in the future, and what kind of emotional help is going to be needed for the community in the months ahead. That's next. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Eric Zion's power was out at his condo at the Champlain Towers South building in Surfside Wednesday night. He had just returned from a trip, and with no electricity, he decided to get a hotel room for himself and his wife. They checked in, and then he returned to the condo.
At 12:30, I put my car in the parking lot, and then I went upstairs to get my scooter. And I was probably in the apartment for 20, 30 minutes, so I probably left like 12:50-ish. Close to 1, and I don't know, that guy over there told me like around 1:15 the building collapsed.
Zion went back to the hotel where he was staying with his wife. About a half hour later or so, part of the building they lived in was gone. It had collapsed. One floor falling down onto another and another until the 12 stories were in a pile of rubble in the basement garage.
I don't know, anything happened until I saw like messages come up on my phone from people in the neighborhood. And I was like, no way, I was just there. And I was literally just there when I put my car in, the whole garage collapsed. So, I mean, my car is totaled, but like, you know, that could have been me.
Zion is one of those left homeless because of the catastrophe. Over 150 people are still unaccounted for as of this afternoon on this Friday. 4 died. Family and friends have been gathering at the Surfside Recreational Center 5 blocks away, waiting for any information on the search and rescue efforts. Donations of clothes, other items, and money have been coming in. So how to help the survivors? What do they need now? And what could be the longer-term trauma from such an unimaginable horror? 800-743-WLRN, our phone number for you to share your experiences, questions. 800-743-WLRN. Healthcare reporter Veronica Zaragovia with WLRN is still with us. Veronica, what resources are provided to the folks displaced by this collapse? We heard earlier from the vice mayor of Surfside talking about some hotel rooms, for instance.
Right. The hotel rooms, there have been efforts to locate apartments that people can stay in. And then there have been needs like cell phone chargers, sweaters, snacks, because the meals and such has been taken care of. But sometimes, like with the, especially younger people, they had been asking for snacks, and also blankets, pillows, these kind of things. Because like Vice Mayor Paul had mentioned that people, you know, had to leave with what was on their back. So right. So those are kind of what I've been told about.
And the reunification center, describe that space. Are people come and go? Is it open overnight, for instance? Give us a sense of what that space is.
It's like kind of like a recreational center. And so there's a big outdoor space where the media are limited to a little corner on the side, so we're not able to get close, but it seems like a lot of people come and go on the outside, kind of talking to each other. And then inside, they had separated the people who suffered trauma, who lived in this particular tower, have been in one part. And then they had, for instance, those who were evacuated from the resort right next door, though they were somewhere else. Now I've been told they've been moved to a hotel, but I don't know if that's 100% of them. But that it seems that the people who were living in the tower, at least some, are still in the recreation center. And yesterday I saw people distraught and crying, leaving or even up until 7 p.m. So it's just, they've also been taking DNA samples from there to match with any information they're getting. So it's a lot of things happening there. Yeah.
a lot of things happening on the charitable side as folks look to assist those survivors and those family members still waiting and searching for answers. Rebecca Fishman-Lipsey is with us now, the president and CEO of the Miami Foundation. Rebecca, welcome to WLRN. Thanks for your time.
Great to be here with you.
I wish it were a better excuse to speak about the charitable giving in this community, but the Miami Foundation, along with some other community foundations in Dade County, have put together supportsurfside.org as a gathering space for charitable giving. How did this effort come to be in just really a matter of hours on Thursday?
Yeah, well, I mean, it is incredibly moving to see what is happening on the ground in Surfside today and yesterday, how many people want to give, how many people want to stand together. And we realized we needed there to be a clear, safe, unifying way for people to donate money in this moment that could go to the families that are facing an unbelievably devastating tragedy. And what you could see there, and you mentioned this earlier, you know, there's donations of things that are coming in, people driving in all the way from Boca with U-Hauls filled with sweaters and blankets and dolls for children. And there are 15 restaurants that are working in rotation to provide meals for those who are displaced, for those who are facing trauma, for those who are in the rescue effort. So the things, the food, the housing is covered. But what's needed now is for us to build a base of support to help families who have lost everything.
And you teamed together with some other foundations here, the Coral Gables Community Foundation, the Key Biscayne Community Foundation, and the Miami Heat, as well as the foundation that you lead, the Miami Foundation. Putting this together, let me ask some just practical questions, and I don't want to take the humanity out of it, but you know, whenever there's money involved, there can be some other effects here. Are these tax-deductible donations? Can they be tax-deductible donations, depending upon the giver?
Yeah, so that's one of the motivations why the Community Foundation stepped together and why the Knight Foundation joined us, the Heat joined us, the Dolphins have joined us, is that we want there to be a clear, safe, tax-deductible way to support the residents and families, and for there to be a process for them to clearly and simply apply and share their need, and for us to be able to then disseminate funds to those both in an immediate and in a long-term way. And so, yes, on that site where people can donate right now, we're currently working on how those in need can share their needs so that we can respond to them. We have some funds dedicated just for immediate needs right now on the ground, but the longer effort is going to be helping people who are affected by this tragedy, who still don't even know where their loved ones are and what's happened and what the state of the loss is going to be for them. But we're pooling resources. We've seen over 1,500 donors come together already. We've raised over $100,000. And we're now in the process in multiple languages of making it really easy for those in crisis to express what they need.
And how are you thinking about the plans for distribution and how to go about having these dollars meet the needs and to get to those individuals who are in need?
Yeah. So, I mean, what's been very helpful is to be on the ground there, speaking with volunteers, speaking with all of the organizations and the government officials and the rescue workers to understand what the state of the need is right now. And what we do see is that the basic human needs in this moment are being met. One of the needs yesterday that we saw that I would never have thought of is that people had to evacuate. They have medications that they need to refill prescriptions and figure out what their needs are. And so healthcare workers figuring out how to fulfill those needs and who's going to pay for that. And there are so many people who are stepping up to help with that in the immediate. But what we need to do is figure out the state of the loss, people who are going to have to be burying family members, rebuilding lives, yeah. Finding longer term solutions for housing. And so we will, based on how much money is raised and based on how many people are displaced and in crisis, we'll have to make some choices about how to put every dollar raised to best use. And we'll be collaborating with all of the foundations in town to make those decisions together.
Apologies for the interruption, Rebecca. Would you imagine these survivors, for instance, applying for a grant? Will there be that kind of process put into place?
So it's a good question. So we need this to be as unburdensome as possible, mm-hmm. but we also need to make sure that this is actually going to those in need who have faced a crisis. And so, and it's, you know, both residents in the building, those who were staying there, people who work and happens to be there at that time. And so we're setting very simple, clear criteria that'll be up on the site. For who it is that can use funds and for what the funds can be used. And we'll make sure that it is translated and simple and unburdensome, but also that we have the ability to vet the need to make sure that the dollars are going where they need to be going.
Rebecca Fishman Lipsey, the CEO, president of the Miami Foundation. Stick with us, Rebecca. I want to add another voice to this conversation about helping the community in need just hours after this unimaginable tragedy. Maria Bedoya is with us, St. Thomas University licensed mental health counselor. Maria, welcome to the program. What are survivors experiencing today, 36 hours after this horror?
Thank you. Thank you for having me join today. And yeah, definitely. I know that this is not an easy moment for everyone, not just the survivors, but everyone that is connected in one way or another, right? From the first responders, from us that are talking about it, from our community at large. So a lot of things are happening, right? A lot of people are experiencing a variety of not just physical trauma, but probably emotional trauma from, you know, the loss of maybe a family member or a friend, but also think about the personal losses that personal sentiments that we might find or that we might have had in the homes, right? So thinking about, you know, that little girl that might have left her collection of teddy bears in the apartment. So, you know, it could be a variety of emotions that they're experiencing at the moment.
Maria, how we were speaking earlier about, you know, the immediate needs, right? Food, water, shelter. Clothes, mm-hmm. in this mm-hmm. case, you talk about emotional support for children. Certainly, those are important things. How does mental health fit in to the initial community response after an event like this?
Definitely, it plays a crucial role in our recovery, right? So our mayor and our vice mayor were talking about search and rescue, and then the next step, which is recovery. And recovery plays many forms in our life, not just physical recovery, but more so on the emotional end. So it's crucial within the first 24 to 48 hours that the community join together, as we have been doing, to provide that support, right? So I'm thinking of the first responders and how they played a crucial role as they're removing people from the rubble, as they're bringing family members to reunite with other family members. That in itself will help process within that person's emotional state. So the idea behind it is that everything that occurs, right? We think of back to 9/11 or Marjory Stoneman Douglas shooting, you know, it can be, our experiences are different, and how we process it can turn into short-term trauma or long-term trauma and have emotional effects. So how we connect together and build those supports emotionally, physically, you know, just building that stability definitely will help in the long run.
Veronica Zaragovia, mm-hmm. our healthcare reporter, WLRN, who's in Surfside. Veronica, Maria brings up such an important point, the emotional mental health of survivors, of first responders. The mayor, Daniela Levine-Cava, and others have spoken about the dedication of fire and rescue and others involved with this search and rescue effort and still holding out hope, and also the importance of mental health even during this physical exertion. What can you share with us about what you've seen or kind of what you have reported on with other types of disasters and the importance of that component?
Yeah, absolutely. Having someone who's maybe familiar with this particular kind of trauma. You know, our colleagues at the Miami Herald have been reporting about a little girl who found out her father has been missing. And I mean, that kind of, it varies when you're a child versus an adult. And also the impact that this kind of situation has on the work, on the people involved in the recovery efforts. I imagine that they're going through a pretty difficult time as well in the Miami-Dade Fire Rescue and all of the agencies from federal down who are now involved. So there will be quite a lot of need.
Rebecca Fishman Lipsey with the Miami Foundation, the charitable effort that that you have spurred on here at supportsurfside.org. Oftentimes, I think it's an assumption that these donations can go to try to make whole a financial loss, right? Or to go to immediate tangible needs. Are you thinking about the kind of charitable giving that's happening at this website at supportsurfside.org and how it may be used for emotional trauma, for mental health in the weeks, months, and perhaps years to come?
There is going to be a very serious need for those who've experienced this. You know, this happened in the middle of the night. People were sleeping in their beds. They heard a noise, and all of a sudden, half of their building was gone. Their neighbors, their friends. It's terrifying. It's going to have long-term impacts on those who were there and those who were nearby, those who worked in the building. And we do need to think about what that long-term recovery looks like for people, not just to recover the things that they lost, but the pieces of themselves they lost in this experience.
You bring up such an interesting point, Maria. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this as a licensed mental health counselor. This struck me yesterday amid the just horrific news that continued to come out of Surfside and continues to. Many of us have spent so much time in our homes during this pandemic. It has been the place where we've stayed to try to stay safe and to try to keep our families safe. And for those living in high-rise buildings, how does this catastrophe impact their sense of security? How do they deal with that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I think the most important thing to understand is it's okay not to be okay, right? I know, like you said, being stuck at home or having been at home for such long period of time and making this our place of security and not having that leads to that sense of insecurity. So very important for those that are displaced or that, you know, now that have lost that home is to find a sense of what is security. So part of our mental health for both adults and children is when we don't have that sense of stability, when there's uncertainty, when there's unknown, that fear, it can definitely turn into anxiety. It can turn into depression. It can manifest in other mental health symptoms. So it's important to try as much as possible to continue with as many, and I say normal in quotations, routines as possible, right? Yeah. What is normal nowadays, right? Yeah. So if I have to go to work, I'm going to work if I can. If my children want to go play, let's take them to the playground. Try to continue building that sense of security because at the end of the day, we are re-experiencing, it's almost a re-traumatization, right? We did experience grief and loss when the pandemic hit, whether we've lost people through the pandemic or just lost our jobs or lost different sense of community engagement. It's almost we're reliving it again, especially those that are part of this Surfside building. So grief and loss is very important to think about.
And Tom, if I could jump in, if there's a minute that I had a couple of thoughts I wanted to add that sometimes we won't notice people suffering in the moment. Yesterday I interviewed someone called Eric DeMora, who had lost his unit, but he survived because he luckily had slept somewhere else the night before. And he said, I can't even begin to process what I've lost and the fact that he hadn't heard from his neighbors. So it's going to be like they might not be sobbing in front of us right now, but people are going to be going through processing their trauma in their own ways. And I did want to take this opportunity, if I may, to ask journalists to be compassionate because I'm standing in these groups of journalists who are sometimes someone will be kind enough to speak with us. And then they're asking questions like, can you show us photos of people who are missing? And I think that we need to stop asking people to relive a certain trauma so that we get a good story and that maybe we consider giving people a little bit of space as they might need it.
Yeah. And Veronica, to add to what you just said, you know, you just brought up a very crucial point, which is survivor's guilt. Right. And that survivor's guilt of traumatic events such as these. Right. It's not just those that survived this incident, but also those that have survived in any other way, shape or form. Survivor's guilt is very something that happens most of the time in these situations. And like you said, it's the symptoms don't appear today. Right. Because everyone's still in the state of shock. It's their body is just in survival mode. It's fight or flight. It's fight or flight or freeze. And until things start slowing down, that's when people really have the opportunity to sit with themselves and think about what happened. What did I just go through? So it's very important, like you mentioned also, Veronica, that, you know, as reporters or whoever, whatever role we each play, is really kind of like how they say in the airlines, we got to focus on ourselves first and where we stand and process our emotions before reaching out to others and showing that empathy and compassion.
Helpful guidance all around. Maria Bedoya with St. Thomas University, licensed medical health counselor. Rebecca Fishman-Lipsey, the Miami Foundation president and CEO. And Veronica Zaragovia, healthcare reporter at WLRN. And all three of you, thank you for sharing your time with us here on the South Florida Roundup.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you for having us.
Still to come on our program, what questions need to be asked to figure out how this happened? That's next. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. In early August of 1974, the Federal Drug Enforcement Agency building in downtown Miami collapsed. Seven people were killed. That catastrophe led to today's regulation that requires buildings 40 years old to be inspected in Miami-Dade County. The Champlain Tower South turned 40 this year and was undergoing its recertification. John Pistorino is with us now, structural engineer, principal in charge at Pistorino and Alam Consulting Engineers. John was a young Miami-Dade County engineering consultant in 1974, working to find the cause of that DEA building collapse. And John, you came up with that recertification plan that's still used today in many South Florida communities. What's involved with a 40-year building inspection?
Yes. Hi. That's correct. Well, what's involved was looking at the vulnerability of concrete structures in South Florida, where we are have a very aggressive environment, salt air with wind, and how it affects concrete buildings. So what we discovered in 74 was that a building that was some 30 years old, the steel had totally corroded in the building and what we call spalled the concrete and cracked it, and the building collapsed. It was a occupied building, and a bunch of people were killed. So we came up with this 40-year recertification of saying that a building that is in South Florida that is 40 years old, assuming that there is properly maintained over its life, the idea of the 40-year is simply to verify to the building official that, the building is still in good condition and will continue to stand as it was originally designed and constructed.
How long does a 40-year inspection take, John, for a building the size of one at the Champlain Towers, for instance?
One on Champlain Towers, normally it would probably take at least a week, maybe 2 weeks, to go through and inspect all the members of the building. It's a visual inspection, unless some items come up that are problematic, which requires, and we require some what we call selective demolition to see, to expose any problems that's not visible to the eye about. We'd like to see if there's hollow concrete, if there's cracked concrete, that type of thing.
John, what questions would you be first asking if you investigate this collapse?
Well, I mean, the first thing I would want to do is first of all, of course, get a hold of the structural plans of the building. I would want to see the 40-year recertification inspection that was in progress. I want to see that. I would like to see all of the history of the building in terms of work that they've done in the past, permits they've pulled, repairs they've done in the past. I would want to see any kind of investigations that have gone on in the past. For instance, I understand there was some investigations about settlement. And then at that particular point, what we would wind up doing is basically having to take the building apart piece by piece, difficult task, but that's the way we do it, to get down to the foundation of the area of the most probability where the collapse occurred. We might want to take what we call soil borings with the geotech labs to see the condition of the soil or the what we call the concrete pile caps. We might take laboratory analysis of some of the concrete to see if it's lost its strength. But primarily, these concrete buildings, they will show just by observing them what we call a failure mode. What actually did fail,
John,
assuming that we can do that.
I apologize for that interruption again. Just a few seconds left here, but what kind of time frame would an investigation take? Could you answer that question in just maybe 20 seconds or so?
Yeah, I would estimate this is going to take at least 3 months, I would think, to do this kind of investigation, given the demolition that has to take place.
You think there could be conclusions within 3 months once the investigation starts?
I do. Yeah, I do. I mean, this is something, this is a very unusual collapse. It should not have, with the first one we've ever had since 74. I just want to say to everybody listening that people who are in high-rise buildings now should be assured that these buildings that we have been built under highest scrutiny and evaluation, and they should not be concerned. We don't know what happened here, but this is totally very unusual. It's very unique.
John, important note there at the end, and I appreciate you saying that. John Pistorino is a structural engineer, principal in charge of Pistorino Consulting Engineers. John, a pleasure to have you on your program. Thanks for sharing your knowledge with us.
Thank you. Take care. Bye.
That'll do it for our program. It is produced by Andrea Perdomo with help from Katie Swetolski-Munoz. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Lance Dixon, our digital editor. News director, Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's director of operations and technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Richard Ives answers the phones. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling, listening, and supporting public radio. Our program here on WLRN is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist.